What makes a car better? All right, well, let's back up. What was it designed to do? Is it meant solely to get you from A to B? You know, is it meant solely to get you from A to B while not killing you? Is it meant to do those things while also being fun?
There is just a few that rise to the top. And it's, I guess, you know, it's like that in every activity, right? Whether it's sports or music or whatever, there's the superstars. And it's not just the car.
Oh, God, don't do this.
Sorry.
And we could fake them out. Maybe like we should all just move our lips but not say anything. And then come on and say, how are the levels?
your funeral, buddy, Mike. Mike, you're going down. We're taking you with us. Okay, hello, and welcome to It's Not the Car, the only podcast that smells like 90-weight hypoid gear oil, which is to say absolutely terrible. But that's okay. This is radio. You don't have to smell us. Heck, you should be grateful. Thank us when you get a chance. I'm Sam Smith. I'm a journalist and a club racer. And if you ask me to, reassemble a Hewland gear stack trackside to change ratios, I could do that. But I'll be very slow and probably speak only in four-letter words for a few minutes and lose about 100 IQ points in the process. Ross, go. Who are you?
I am Ross Bentley, an XXXX former driver, race driver, and current driver coach and current tinkerer with a Lotus with Sam's help.
I have so many questions. There's your first mistake. My help is useless. Jeff, who are you?
I'm Jeff Brown. I have also changed gears in Hewland Mark 9s, but not recently in any of the extract stuff. But as a race engineer, I tell the mechanics what gears to put in it. So that's what I do.
That seems like the smart way to do it. You make race car different. Now I have coffee. I sit. So we like to change it up around here because most of us were born without frontal lobes. I'm pretty sure Jeff was born with an extra frontal lobe. That's why he's deeply intelligent. Ross and I basically just gape at the mic when he starts to talk. But we change up formats around here because it's entertaining and because, I don't know, we have reasons. Today's format is a return to something we call Sam Tells a Story. And that's where I talk about something with which I am familiar and hopefully don't, you know, use words like with which too often, because this isn't grammar study hall and we're not masterpiece theater librarians. But in this case, the topic is, drum roll, please. I would do drums on the desk, but I'm very bad at that. There you go. Secrets of car journalism. See, you can't even when you put a deep voice on it, it doesn't sound impressive. Car journalists aren't serious people. None of this is impressive. But all of this is pegged on the release of my new book. It's Smithology, 20 Years of Thoughts, Travels, and Semi-Plausible Car Ratings. It's out now on Amazon. You can buy it. It's my writing, a summary of my writing, kind of anthology. As you may or may not know, I was executive editor of Road & Track for 8 years. I've written for many, many other places in the business, from Car & Driver and the New York Times to Esquire and Wired, kind of specialized in adventures, motorsport stuff, people, race cars, other ridiculous things like that. So we're going to talk about that job a bit today. Disclaimer, though, I've done zero prep for this. I don't know what's going to happen. Ross and Jeff are going to ask me questions. I don't know what they're going to ask me. I may not have answers to a lot of it. Some of those answers might be useless, but I'm going to try. And moreover, I am famously uncomfortable talking about myself. I just don't think any of my life is that interesting. So Ross and Jeff have a job ahead of them. They're going to play journalist, which is like saying, I don't know, you're going to, you know, it's just a form of self-torture, really. 20 years of self-torture. But guys, I am in your hands. Let's go.
So Sam, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word. Well, you know, when I was younger, it was the, and now it's probably a, or it might be two, or maybe it's two, the, I don't know. See, I'm already boring. We shouldn't do this. Should I turn the tape off? We should turn the tape off.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
You're a journalist, an automotive journalist. You're at Road & Track. Mm-hmm. You get to test all the cars. You know, all the manufacturers, obviously, the way I understand it, would like to have Road & Track say, well, this is the most amazing car we've ever tested, and then they sell more cars. So they give you a car to go try out. Mm-hmm. What happens if you crash that thing? Like,
oh,
I mean,
man,
sideways. And has it ever happened?
Has it ever happened?
Well, to first, you or to, you know, when you've been on a test thing, you know, has everybody, like, balled one up and like, uh-oh.
I mean, yes. Famously, the business is full of people who do not have a lot of seat time in, what's the word, vehicles, or have a lot of seat time and think they're a lot better than they are. So I personally, I've had in 20 years, I've had a couple of incidents. Those are probably whole shows in themselves. But by and large, it's the way the industry works is that pretty much everybody who tests vehicles they don't pay for the cars when they get them. The cars are either borrowed from an owner or they're borrowed far more often. They're borrowed from manufacturer fleets around the country, right? Where manufacturers have marketing fleets and a series of kind of either crusher cars or things that are going to be used later for advertising or photography. And those are handed out to not just journalists, but celebrities and marketing agencies and a bunch of other people. And so what happens when somebody screws up and wraps one of those things around a tree, which happens more often than you'd expect, because it's also a kind of unwritten rule in the business. And I never believed in this, but it's an unwritten rule in business that you don't talk about that sort of thing publicly, because A, it makes you look bad. B, it makes the place you work for look bad. And C, it makes the person who loaned you the car look bad. Again, I've had two major incidents in my career over 20 years. One was I was very young and very stupid, and that's actually promo. That's actually in the book. It involved a Ford GT, the thing that looked like a Ford GT40 from the 1960s, the supercar they built in 2005 and 2006 to commemorate one of Ford's anniversaries. But the other one was just bad luck, wrong place, wrong time. But for the most part, I've talked about those. I've publicly talked about those. Like I said, I've clearly just published a book with a big essay on it. But most people simply don't. And they don't because they can get away with it. It's funny, too, because when that happens, when somebody wraps a car around a tree or throws some exotic into the wall at Laguna or Sears Point or wherever the hell it is, it's just quietly cleaned up and taken away. Most of the time, the publication, the journalists don't pay for it. And that's pretty much the way it's always been, dating back to, you know, the beginnings of the industry in the 30s, 40s, 50s, really, really post-war. But it's a strange, stupid quirk of the business. And it's, like I said, most people don't talk about it, but I always felt, you know, we are human, and most of the people in the business end up over the course of a career covering millions of miles in literal thousands and thousands of cars. And some of that is track lapping. Some of that is, you know, it used to be very common that car magazines, you needed to hop into a car you'd never seen on a racetrack you'd never seen and go through one corner over and over again and do big, slidey, sloppy, tire smoky drift shots. And, you know, there's an awful lot of risk. And frankly, the fact that it happens is a reflection of the fact that some of the people in the business don't really know what they're doing or just simply don't have a lot of experience. And, you know, in a lot of cases, it's just a reflection of the fact that shit happens. But does that answer your question?
Yep.
So you touched on something there that some don't know what they're doing. Talk to us about the... In a way that I know that you will, you know, you're not going to say, you know, so-and-so doesn't have a clue what they're doing. But what's the general level of driving abilities amongst automotive journalists?
I mean, the old cliche is there is no level, right? The joke is that there is no level. They're beneath the rest of humanity. We are all terrible people, I will say that. But it's probably easier to say... to speak generally, right? And I have no desire to throw anybody under the bus. There are still some very, very good drivers in the business. There are more than a few people who have club racing licenses, who have a handful who have held pro racing licenses and done very well, competed or podiumed in places like 24 Hours of Nürburgring. But by and large, those people are the exception. I am uncommon because I've held a lot of competition licenses. But again, that doesn't, I mean, as we all know, holding a license doesn't necessarily mean you're any good. It just means they gave you the license. But the general, I'm sorry, there are so many different stories. Hell, the general, most racing drivers at an amateur level would probably run rings around most journalists at a track day. And that's being kind in a lot of cases, simply because there is no, and as the business has shrunken, as the money's left the business, as advertising dollars have left the business, as publications have had less and less money for salary, there's been less and less incentive for people who are qualified to get into the business. And the people who do get into the business have had less incentive to learn, educate themselves, and use the time and the access to get better, right? Ross and I have a mutual friend who, you know, we've famously spent a lot of time at track days and enduros with. And one of his lines is that, you know, he's worked in the business. And one of his lines is that, you know, the business will let you get better if you want it to. It will very much help you get better. You have massive access to data, to instructors, to seat time, to guided seat time, to coach seat time, to, you know, to time in club race cars, and in some cases in pro cars with other people paying the bills. And, you know, in some cases, it's just that the people, in many cases, actually, it's just that the people writing and ending up in the business or even filming on YouTube, whatever it is, don't have any incentive to go chase it or don't want to. But
Sam, you fortunately for me, got me involved with writing a little bit for Road and Track. And yeah. I got invited to come and participate in the Performance Car of the Year when we did that that year at Thunder Hill. And there were, remind me, I don't know, five?
Yeah, we actually...
I'm going to say five journalists and me.
Yeah.
And my takeaway from that was, okay, these are not the fastest drivers in the world, but they're pretty damn capable. But yeah. Here's what impressed me was the stuff that, I don't know, Travis would hop in a car, do three laps and get out of the car and go, car does this, 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 and this. I'm going, wow, you know, I've spent my life driving cars and giving feedback to engineers like Jeff, and I'm not sure I could feel that in three laps. So I'm going to say there's a little bit, to me, I came away going, there's a bit of a different skill set there. Okay, it's not the fastest lap, but it's the ability to sense what the car is doing and you know, the feeling that you got back from a car. I was impressed with that.
Well, thanks. And that's, again, that was an exception. Road and Track, especially in that era, had more than a few people who were, we had a handful of club racers on staff, Travis in particular, you know, he came up in karts, but it had more than a few people who were very, very self-aware. And by that, I mean, they knew what they knew and, more important, what they didn't know. And they had no desire to prove anything. You know, the great thing, I think I've said this before, and forgive me, we talked about this on an episode a while back, but the great thing about business is if you do pay attention, very early on, you get a very accurate picture of where you sit. You get a chance to put your data, your lap times in the same car on the same tires on the same day at the same track with people who have won Daytona with, you know, in one case, you know, I got to line up my data in a Ferrari at Fiorano up against Kimi Raikkonen's on the same tire on the same day. And you look at that and you go, oh, okay, I was trying at about 95% of what I know I can do without risking anything. And he's Kimi, so he was being Kimi, minus, you know, gorilla suits and whatever the hell else he does in his weekends in Finland. But I look at that and I think, you know, there's a very clear picture of what I don't know, what I do know. And you get to take that chunk of your ego and throw it away if you want. And at that point, you really kind of free yourself up to start asking what else you don't know. And I kind of built my whole career around that notion, and that all I was really concerned with was learning. I didn't really want any credit for who I was or wasn't or what I had done. Excuse me. So it was all just hung on trying to be aware. And at that point at Thunder Hill, that Road and Track test, Ross, most of those people really, really cared about, actually all of those people really cared about the brand and really cared about figuring out what it needed to be. Because at the core, you know, car magazines, car media, journalism in general, YouTube, it's all about it's communication, right? It matters that you understand what you're talking about and you know it intimately and you know the business intimately and you know how to talk about, well, that's shock understeer, that's bar understeer, that's the car has too much toe, and also I'm a monkey and I used my hands are too handsy understeer, right? But it also matters that you get out of the thing and then you be able to translate that. We famously, early on had, especially at R&T, where, you know, it has a long history of motorsport coverage, has a long history of respect in the business. And, you know, it was a point, you know, you can work at Road and Track and call pretty much any racing driver in the business and say, hey, would you like to come help us with this? And they'll say yes, because it's R&T. Doesn't matter how big or small it is. It means something.
Yep.
So, you know, there was a point where we were trying to open up the ranks a little bit and trying different drivers and, you know, so-and-so from this series, so-and-so from this series. And we very, you know, you very quickly learned that it's not how fast they are on the car, because everybody's quick. If you're at the pro level, you know, you're quick enough to test street cars. You may not be quick enough to win, you know, pick massive international race here, but you're quick enough to test street cars and get something out of it. But by and large, most of the drivers we threw into really fast exotics. And in some cases, remember, like, you know, these are 500, 600, 800, 1,000 horsepower cars that have, that might pull, you know, 1.2, 1.3 Gs in a fast corner, that have aero that's not real by race car standards, but is real by road car standards. You know, you unbolt the wing, the car gets looser. You know, the floor does something, maybe not a lot, but something. But, you know, we'd throw really competent drivers in them, in those things. And they'd come out and they say, well, you know, it pushes a little here and the car's a little unstable off the brakes, but like, it could really be faster if this, that, the other. And, you know, like it's a really high torque brake compound, but at the same time, like, this, that, and the other, and, you know, turn five, blah, 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 picks up a push mid corner. It's like, well, how is that relevant to what you can communicate that tells the story of that car, right? Yep. It's useful. But if you write that test up, and there are outlets in the business that have this issue, you write that test up, it ends up looking like a book report or an engineering report. It doesn't make you care.
But Sam, so the if you're writing for Road and Track or other similar publications or websites now for road cars, it's not all about, I'm assuming the reader doesn't care just about which car is the fastest, because they don't go out and make their purchase based on necessarily which is the fastest. So a person who tests those cars has a different job than a race car driver, right? Race car driver's trying to make the car be the fastest car.
Of course.
To do a report on a street car, you have to, there's a combination of things. Some of it is, you know, I'm sure seating position, or the seat wasn't comfortable, or I couldn't see the speedometer, or I couldn't reach the radio knob and stuff like that, because that's important to a person buying a car. So I would imagine that the automotive journalist has to look at different things and report on that stuff too. Kind of like Ross was saying, it's a different skill set, right?
It is. But think about it. The really interesting thing for me, and what I loved about it, was that matters, but you get to pick and choose where and when those things are relevant, right? So go back to sports cars, or, you know, track cars, right? Stuff that's designed to do dual purpose duty. At the end of the day, the thing that matters with a fast car or even a slow involving car, something like a Miata, isn't how fast it laps, where it picks up a push, what the brakes feel like in a corner when you're trailing and you screw up and you pop off the brake and, oh God, does the car punish you for that? Those things are important. What matters is how that works into how the thing feels, whether the person who bought it is going to get the experience that they want, that they, you know, that the company who sells the car promised them, and whether all that works into a cohesive kind of enjoyable packages. There are very, very fast, very, very capable cars that, you know, will lap racetracks all day long without turning to a pile of dust, that leave you emotionally dead, that, you know, at the limit are spicy and hairy in a way that, you know, nobody short of, you know, Scott Dixon on a mound of coke could ever keep up with. And that's part of it. You know, I guess what I'm trying to say isn't that, you know, the racing driver side of it doesn't matter, or no, the cup holders are 2 inches too far to the left. This Camry, a pile of junk. What matters is the cohesive whole. And so many people lose sight of that. And I always found it really interesting. And there are right ways and wrong ways to do everything, but there's no wrong way to try and tell a story unless you lose sight of who you're talking to, I guess. And ultimately, you know, if this is all about figuring out how to get something across to somebody, whether that's, well, the GT3 RS does X in 120 mile an hour corner, or man, the rear shocks on that Camry are garbage. Like they get real hot. And then all of a sudden the back axle goes away and like stability control has to keep the car underneath it on a mountain road at like 5 miles an hour beneath the speed limit. That's a hot mess. Like it's all about what the thing was designed to do and whether it lands that gig, right?
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say, like, for me, because I grew up reading Road and Track and Car and Driver and Hot Rod magazine. And, you know, like as a kid, I was, you know, I learned to read with car magazines. Yeah. And there were a few writers that stood out. And it seemed like I guess it was kind of like, you know, you can look at IndyCar racing or Formula One or NASCAR or whatever. There's always like that top 3 to 5 drivers that are consistently the best. And it strikes me that in the automotive journalism world, it's the same kind of thing. There are certain journalists who can write, but maybe they can't drive. There are some that can drive who can't write. But more importantly, then there's those few that can do those things and find that meaning, that story behind it. And those were the few, those were the special ones. Those were the world champions. Hmm. And yeah, that's why I'm looking forward to your book, because I get to read world champion stuff. So, but
the check's in the mail, Ross. Thank you. That promo is very appreciated. Yeah.
But I'm going to say, you know, there's just a few that rise to the top. And it's, I guess, you know, it's like that in every activity, right? There's, whether it's sports or music or whatever, there's the superstars. And it's that, almost that thing that it's hard to describe, but it's the finding that meaning, the, you know, it's not just the car.
Oh God, don't do this.
Sorry.
No,
do you think that's a, like, were you born with that?
I don't know how that happens. You're right. I can think of many, many people in the business who are very good at a chunk of it, but not at the whole. And I'm flattered that you say that I'm good at all of it. Thank you. But I can think of only a few people that nail every single one of the buttons. And those are names that you know, that end up being at the top of the business, or end up, you know, as the business crumbles, end up continuing to get work. For me, it was just always, what's really interesting about anything you do is that if you care, if you try, and if you really, really want to be better at it, and you acknowledge that there is no end to that, right? Like Tuesday, you might be better than, you know, so-and-so, and really good at X and Y, and have just think you've got it nailed. And you wake up Wednesday and you look at it and you're like, wow, well, what's next? I'm done? Okay. Well, if you ever think that you're done trying to improve at anything, right? Then there's no, you're clearly not. And you're also sliding backward. And for me, I just constantly wanted to, and still want to, get better and just keep learning. And I, you know, I spent a lot of time, I grew up around a restoration shop. I got into club racing fairly early, even though I didn't, not early, but race car standards, by driver standards, but, you know, in my teens and 20s, and did it terribly, but wanted to be better at it. And, you know, I kept the copy of the Skip Barber book, Going Faster, on my toilet tank for 5 or 8 years, just because I'd go in there, pick it up, and you have your time by yourself, and you read a chapter or 3 chapters, and just over and over again. And I was the same way with engineering and how things work and how writing works and how stories work. And not because I felt like I had to, but because I wanted to, because I couldn't stop. And I think, I mean, we've talked about this with drivers, with people who try and improve, you know, in any kind of performance. It's the number one thread between all the people I know who are very good at it is they just care. And you couldn't stop them from caring if you put a gun to their head. And that's only gotten more evident as all of the money exited the business, as the salaries have dropped and it's become harder and harder to do it, you know?
So you've, you talked about very good people who are very good at what they do. I'm sure in your articles and in your work, you've got to work with really good race car drivers. I know you've worked with Ross before, but I'm sure you've worked with other guys at, you know, like top pros other than just Ross. So my question is, in that experience, has there been any, because you were a good, let's call you semi-pro driver, and the good semi-pros against the real pros that make their living doing it are oftentimes amazed. They're just like, man, I don't know how he does it. I'll never be able to do that. That's just, wow, that's amazing what they can do in the same car. I'm sure you've experienced that. But I want to know the other side. Have you ever had a pro guy come and do a test with you and gone, wow, he just can't figure out this street car or this street tire. You know, he can only do high downforce, super grippy tires, and you put him in the street car and he was horrible.
I mean, yes. And I'm kind of...
You don't have to name names.
Oh, I wouldn't. I'm kind of reluctant to talk about it because it can make... This is in no way, again, I'm very aware of what I do terribly as a racing driver. Ross and I could talk about that for years on end, but I have met people like that and worked with people like that. And you try them, you know, in the magazine business, you try them once, and if they can't tick any of the boxes, that matters, that the communication boxes. And but the bigger thing is, you know, clearly if you bring in a guy to be the shoe or bring in a guy or woman, whoever it is, to set consistent times and pull consistent data, and your staff members are matching them and they can't go out there and get more out of it, does that mean that your staff members can go sit in front of the grid at Indy? No. Does that mean that your staffers could, like, you know, rip around the ring in the rain in the 24 and not stack the car up 1,000 times a lap? No. That means that, it's like you talked earlier, that piece of the skill set isn't there. And the fact of the matter is, like, it is an oddly specific skill to get into a car after, in some cases, a handful of laps and get out of it and go, well, you know, the tire on the Mercedes has more gentle breakaway than the tire on the Toyota, but the tire on the Mercedes puts understeer into the car when it gets hot, and the tire on the Toyota is more consistent. And to do that in three laps on a track you've never seen is a skill. Doesn't mean it's difficult, just means it's a skill. If you don't get that together, you can't deliver. And those people we kind of veered away from using and never went back to. You know, the other side of it is you are dealing with, you know, A, street tires, which are not race tires. Even the most evolved of the, you know, what they call R compound tires, especially the stuff that shows up on production cars, the stuff that's designed to do real, real serious dual duty, like, you know, Michelin Pilot Sport Cup 2, or, God, my brain is blanking on the others in the market. There's really not much like the Cup 2 at the moment, but those tires are, you know, that's a tire that's designed to be not suicidal in the rain, have a glass point that's still relatively high, meaning, like, you go out on a 45 degree day, you're not going to die if you're a grandmother in Poughkeepsie, and at the same time pull, you know, 1.2 or 3 or 4 or whatever it is g, or, you know, car driver just ran their Lightning, or published their Lightning lap numbers where they go every year to VIR with a big stack of performance cars. And I think the GT3 RS this year was hucking through the uphill S's at a $150. And that's a road car. That is a bone stock road car. Oof. And that's moving. Like, that's serious, serious motion. And yet that's not, you know, it's not a race car. It has airbags. It has air conditioning. It has leather seats. There is so much in that thing that makes it not a race car, that makes it not respond like a race car, and that the tires need different treatment. There's, you know, billions of reasons why. And some people just can't get under that. And there are people, you know, I've been in situations where I went out and, you know, we had something that made a decent amount of downforce for road car, thinking of a particular hypercar at this point, made decent amount of downforce, like, to the point where you had to take advantage of it and trust it in a spooky way. And we had a particular pro there who had a very impressive resume. And I came in, there were people from the manufacturer there. And I came in after doing some siding laps and then kind of ripped off a couple of, you know, 9.5 tenths or whatever it is laps. And came in, I'm like, okay, well, you know, the pro guy go out on it. Cool. That's awesome. I have notes. I learned things, and talked to the manufacturer people. And then pro came out, pro came back in, talked to manufacturer people, yada, yada, yada. And then heard through another party the next day or a couple of days later that, you know, the pro had been basically, we had told him to go out and get everything out of the car. And the pro had come in and basically pulled absolutely down to the like 10th or 100th my same times. And again, I'm not the best guy in the world, not even the best guy in the business. And that moment was instructive because A, it taught me, well, okay, I'm not a complete hack. I guess that makes me feel good. But B, it reminded me that, you know, at the end, like there is just so much about the way road cars work that isn't always obvious. And if you grew up, or even if you spent your, not grew up, but spent your entire career on massive spring rate, massive downforce, and purpose-built race tires, a lot of those things, they don't translate. And they don't translate in ways you wouldn't expect. It's why, it's why development drivers in particular, manufacturers, are so, so interesting to talk to. Because they're not concerned about absolute lap time. They're concerned about, in most cases, they're concerned about whether the car will be approachable by a normal human who did not come up the way, you know, your average Indy winner or your average Le Mans winner did. That's a long answer, but does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It makes a lot of sense. But it triggers, and maybe this is a slight tangent here, but
it's okay, Ross. It's this show. It's an entire show made of tangents.
Tangents. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So talk to us about the fact that there are cars now that will do 150 up through the S's at VIR, and that a 16-year-old, 17-year-old can drive, can get their hands on.
Yeah.
And we've got cars like that, like everywhere. And you know, I don't know how quick is a Tesla. I don't know. It's bloody fast, like in a straight line. And I don't know.
Even apparently some NFL players can get their hands on cars like that.
Yeah.
So, okay. So perspective is interesting, right? There's, what was it? The Bugatti Veyron famously was, you know, the first car to break into 2 seconds to 60 miles an hour. I remember growing up, you know, there was a particular issue of Road and Track that had a 993 Porsche Turbo on the cover. And it was a big, big deal because the thing, I think that cover was the one where it was wheels, four wheels up over a jump at full droop in the air. I could still see the car. It was maroon. But there was a big, big deal in the issue because it was 3.9, right? And these days, 3.9 seconds to 60. And these days, those times are slow. Like a Tesla will rip a Bugatti. The plaid version of the insane, silly Tesla will rip a first-generation Veyron in the quarter. Maybe not, you know, once you get out of the quarter, but it for most of the quarter, it will leave the Veyron or match it. And, you know, that's a Tesla. That's a heavy, heavy car. It doesn't have a lot of tire on it. It's not a performance car. It just happens to make performance. There's a difference there. And so much of the way the industry has evolved has hung on something that can be sold, right? A number that can be thrown into an advertisement or a TV ad. And hucked. And, you know, in that process, we've ended up with really, really absurdly potent things that aren't always more entertaining, but more important, don't necessarily get entertaining until the 11th, 10th. And if you can hand somebody one of those things at Road America and they're doing a buck 60 going into braking for turn one and they panic and they don't do anything, because they've never been on a racetrack before and it's their first time lapping and they signed up for a day that doesn't have instructors or any graduated anything and they're just out there, you know, they're going to plow it head on into the fence at a speed that will kill them.
But Sam, if they do that on a racetrack, that's one thing. But a freeway off ramp.
So I got on a tangent
that might
there. Forgive
collect
me.
Somebody yeah. else along the way. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not trying to be, you know, no. the old man responsible and everything, but I mean, it's a weird world we're living in right now. And in some ways, really, really cool. And in some ways, just a little bit like, wow.
And
that's what I was talking about, that, you know, the it dates this podcast, but just last week, you know, a Lamborghini and a Corvette racing each other with NFL player in it crashed in Dallas because they were racing each other and some lady coming back from the zoo with her kid changed the lane to move out of the way and hit the other car and wiped out both of those cars. I mean, man, there's some fast, fast stuff available out there, which is cool.
But you should do it at the track. Yeah.
And I
think there was a guy named James Dean that crashed like years and years ago. The cars weren't that fast.
Right.
So
it happens.
It happens. Right. But it's just,
now we'll take the flip of that. I saw, and maybe I shouldn't have even bring this up, but I'm going to, because it's what we do. I saw a picture of it was at Sears Point or Laguna, I can't remember, of a crashed streetcar that had rolled over last week. And the report was that a very experienced professional factory driver had rolled the thing.
Yeah. That,
I mean,
that's another,
that can't be good.
That's another discussion entirely. And Ross is right, right? So James Dean died famously, for those who don't know, James Dean died in the 1950s in a Porsche 550 Spyder, which, you know, at the time was a road car, but it was a road car that they ran at Le Mans, right? Because that's how things worked then. He famously died in an intersection in California in the middle of the state in the Central Valley, because, you know, he ran into his name was Donald Turnipseed. He ran into the side of a Ford, a 40s Ford hits a 550 Spyder, which is, you know, barely a few inches tall and weighs absolutely nothing and is built of tube and sheet aluminum. And one of those things is not going to come out of it. And that, you know, that's an old problem. And yet, you know, there's something about the curve in the last 20 or 30 years. And this is to neither demonize it nor praise it, just to state where we are. So, you know, when I say that, you know, you can be doing $160 going into turn one at Road America and have no idea what you're doing, that also obviously means that you can be doing $140 on the average on ramp in a couple blinks of an eye. And if that's possible and restraint is required to not get there, that's one thing. The interesting thing about the way the curve has evolved is that most of those cars do not wake. They don't feel like anything until you get them up above 8 or 9 tenths. Steering doesn't wake up. The chassis doesn't feel like any weight's moving around. The tires don't, it's hard to get heat in the tires, hard to keep them there. You know, the brakes are, it's a road car, and road car brakes these days are pretty phenomenal, especially at the top end. But by and large, even those aren't fully up to temp. And there's the discussion, there's a very interesting discussion to be had around all of that, which is essentially, should these things, is it irresponsible to produce something where it's absolutely dead ass boring until you are railing on it? And when you are railing on it, you're tripling the speed limit. That to me is the bigger problem, not whether cars are too fast for the roads. I happen to believe that, you know, there is a point where too much tire, too much spring, too much power is boring as hell on a road. The old line is, it's more fun to drive a slow car fast than fast car slow. Yes, I'm in that camp. I'm a dork. Do I also want the most power grip, in some cases downforce, in some cases the most slidey whatever on a racetrack? Yeah. Like the old Walt Whitman line is, I contain multitudes. But it's such a compelling, interesting problem, because we are reaching the limit of what the technology can work, where the technology can work and remain interesting. And, you know, the GT3RS at VIR, the Car and Driver Test, one of the things that Car and Driver published in that story, they had Pat Long, the sports car driver, and a Porsche ambassador along to do laps in the RS. And, you know, he got out of the car and he's like, that's the fastest I've ever been through the climbing S's in a polo shirt and the and an open face helmet, I think. And the unspoken answer there was, are you uncomfortable with it? And no, you know, they didn't publish whether they asked him that. But, you know, I don't know if where this goes or where it ends. And a Tesla is perfect proof of it, because you do 3 or 4 launch control launches in a Tesla, you get nauseous, and then you're like, all right, now what? You go through, you know, you see people who buy, you see it with long ago as people buying Mark V Supras, or in the 60s, you know, big block Camaros. You throw enough turbocharger on something, enough cam and piston, and make enough power, whatever it is. Eventually you're like, yeah, okay, that, but is there more? Because the novelty wears off. All that's interesting is how something feels and whether it engages you and needs you present, right?
So I gotta, it's the elephant in the room. Okay.
Jeff's not that fat. Come on.
We all know.
He just made a trunk with his face.
The way to get a good review in a car magazine is just up your ad budget. Like every road test is driven by the ad department, correct?
No, we talked a bit about this on the last car magazine episode, but go on. I'm curious where you're going with this. What's
well,
the question?
I'm just, you know, how much of it, I guess, you know, this is a little bit of the automotive journalist secrets.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Is there a secret little nod that you get from somebody that says, say something nice about this car?
Kind of like those. I'm just going to add on to Ross's thing there, like those extended test drives. Did they just give you like a Ferrari 488 for 6 months and you get to drive it? And how can you say that it was horrible? I hated it. You know, I mean, you have to say it's good, right?
Okay. So let's pull this apart. So go back earlier. So I have to be careful here because I don't want to tread on what we already talked. Cause this is such, there's so many threads to pull here. It's such an interesting subject because it's how the business runs, right? Because the obvious question is if those cars are all loaned by the manufacturer, you say something the manufacturer doesn't like, the manufacturer can turn off the car, right? Just stop giving you cars. And the long and short of it is in many cases, yes. And that does happen. In some cases, you know, there was a period at Road and Track where, I'll not name names, but do specific. We had some people who ended up getting early access to an Acura NSX development car on a tire that may or may not have been the final ship tire. And they came back and in print, we ran things that were uncomplimentary about the tire, were uncomplimentary about the tire choice, uncomplimentary about the way the car felt and handled. And there was pushback from Acura. There was pushback from, I believe, the tire manufacturer. Ads were withdrawn. Road and Track being Road and Track, Acura couldn't say, you're not getting cars from us, but they were cold to us for a year or so, year and a half. And the short answer, Ross, is that it all hangs on the people in the business. That office, and I was lucky enough to only ever work with people who firmly believed, screw them, you know, you say what you say, you take the lumps. But that office at the time, everybody was like, well, no, I'd rather be honest in print. Do it. Like it matters. And there were some changes to that car this was the second generation NSX. So the one that just left production a couple of years ago, there were some changes to that car in production. I don't believe they reflected what we said, but the point is what we said got heard, started a discussion, and Acura was like, well, okay, screw you guys. And that changed that relationship. Some, to go back to the conversation about people, some editors will use that as a sign to about face and say, nope, mm-mm. Especially, and you know, clamp down on what a writer says, what gets said on a video, especially as the business model has dried up, as advertisements have gone away. You see it a lot on YouTube. You know, find an influencer who says something negative about a car they've been loaned. You can't. In part, I take that back. That's unfair. They're very, very rare. I can think of a handful off the top of my head. Now that I think about it, I shouldn't have said that. They are rare, but it does happen. And it all comes down to why the people are there, why the people who are doing the reviewing and the writing and the filming are there, who has their back and how they feel about it. And I was lucky enough to, and in some cases, kind of sort of steered my career to be around people who have the same morals and ethics as I did. But there are, you know, there are publications that are known for it. There are publications that are known for never publishing a negative word on certain marks.
It's important. I think it's important to the manufacturer. And I don't live in that streetcar world, but yeah. I worked for Mazda for a while on their IMSA prototype car and got to talk to a lot of the Mazda marketing people and the corporate people. And they were very, very, very proud of the fact that, and I'm going to get this wrong, you'll know what it really is, Sam, but the Miata, whatever version of the Miata was out, it always seemed to garner this most fun sports car you can get. Mm-hmm. Certainly wasn't the fastest by any means, but the most fun to drive, the most, you know, like you said, approachable or the most sporty or interesting, or, you know, it got some kind of award like that, like a car that most people could afford that gave you the coolest, most sporty car, fun ride. And they were really proud of that. And so my question was it? I mean, like, how do you do a report and say, wow, the Miata was better than the Lamborghini?
Oh man, that's, first off, better is such bad. I love loaded.
I mean, that's the problem, right?
Yeah, like, I love loaded words. Better is such a loaded word. It's like should, right? Well, you really start pulling it apart. There's so much there. Like, what makes a car better? All right, well, let's back up. What was it designed to do? What is the primary target of its build, right? Is it meant solely to get you from A to B? You know, is it meant solely to get you from A to B while not killing you? Is it meant to do those things while also being fun? Is it meant simply to crank out a lap time? Like, if you want to crank out a lap time, by that metric, you know, the sheer dollar per pound and horsepower and aero grip and lap time, you know, the Viper ACR, the last Viper ACR, Dodge Viper ACR, was absolute king of the hill for the longest time. And yet, you know, I love a Viper, but there are a lot of people who got into it and said, man, you can't see out of it. It sounds like a truck. The V10 is split. There's a pipe on each side of the door, and it's just this big, nasty, beastly thing. And like, I don't want to put it through a corner at a buck 40. Like, I do, but a lot of people felt that way.
How do you get like
car
of the year?
Like, so that's
I know it's super subjective, but I wondered, you know, we're talking about secrets.
Yeah.
How was that? I mean, there must have been arguments if you're doing Car of the Year or whatever the title, each magazine seems to have something like that each year. Like, if I was voting Car of the Year, my Ford F-150 pickup truck, I mean, I think that thing's awesome because it can do what I want it to do, right? But what you want it to do or your other staff at Road and Track want it to do might be completely different. So how do you guys sit around and come up with the best car?
Those conversations are fantastic. I love them. I've always loved them because, again, like, we can go back to the Miata, right? So the Miata is particularly interesting because it does a lot with very little, and it's designed to do a lot with very little. So it's that car packages gobs of steering feel, gobs of rear end feel, a motor that these days is engaging and cammy and encourages you to rev it and pays off when you rev it. You feel like you've done something and you shift it, and there's this feeling like the gearbox is satisfying. The clutch is easy. The gearbox is just notchy enough. You can see out of it. The car feels small. It rotates. There's those things all come together holistically. It's like asking how do you describe a good, and if you're an engineer, you could pull this apart, but how do you describe a good ham sandwich? Well, is it just the ham? Is it just the bread? Is it just the cheese? No, it's like, okay, well, I want a little bit of crust, and the cheese needs to be just melty enough, but not goopy. It can't overpower the ham. The ham needs to be salty and savory, but maybe a little bit of condiment. But if you're tasting nothing but mayo, it's not a ham sandwich, it's a mayo sandwich. And the Miata is universally held up because it's one of those cars that does not, you can always tell when these track tests are run because there are things that sit parked. People go out, do a couple of laps, leave them. And then there are things that people just keep getting into. And the Miata is one of those things. It's got that. It hits all the metrics that it's designed to hit in the business. It's affordable. It's built to do a job and it does it well. It's economical. It's comfortable. It's relatively quiet. It has a decent trunk. It's relatively quick for what it is. And it's relatively durable and it looks good. And it's, you know, you go down a back road and it does X, Y, Z, and it's also the intangibles of A, B, and C. And yet, you know, you take that, the Miata is such a great lens because you can take it and go, okay, well, that Lamborghini cost 10 times as much. Is it 10 times as all of those things? No. Some cases it's not even 1.5 times. Some cases it's like 1.1 times. And so those discussions, and it varies from magazine to magazine. Some magazines really hang on how fast the thing is. You know, in the 1990s, Car and Driver was famously all about the points system where, like, you know, you look at something like, I remember reading these things being like, who the hell cares? You said that your interior was an 8 and Bob on the other side of the staff said the interior was a 7. And so you average it out to a between the other guys was a 7.5. And so that it won by half a point over the Chevy. Like, who cares? Like, what does that even mean? It's gibberish. But, you know, that was an engineer's at the time. That magazine was run by a very nice man, very smart man named Chubachetta. And that was his evolution of a system that engineers at the magazine before had developed in a typical engineer fashion to kind of pull things down into a rating system. The other way you can look at it is how a lot of other places work, which is blending all the holistic things and then in a conversation and then trying to translate that conversation to the page. And for much of my time at Road and Track, we leaned heavily on numbers while blending in that conversation, which is what made it so interesting. Because you could say, man, the Aston is like, I don't know, 5 seconds slower around Thunder Hill. And I got like left behind on that back road by the dude in the Porsche. But the Aston kind of does kind of more fun. And I kind of want to go around in the Aston for the rest of the week. And the Porsche is like, fine. So so much of it hangs on the staff and where you are and how the systems work, but like what the editorial system and the review system, the engineering system, the data system set around that particular publication, if it chooses to look at things like that. A lot of places don't, but it's that crossed with the people. And man, there was 1 year at Road and Track. I vividly remember this. So going back to the whole thing where, you know, all right, so-and-so, these Car X got awards year after year after year, like in the 90s and 2000s and 80s. Car and Driver famously was, you know, people would write in and be like, how much money is BMW paying you? Every single BMW is pretty great. What is wrong with you guys? You're all broken. And, you know, that quietly stopped about 10 years ago when BMW stopped being great, when every single one of them wasn't great, when like the good ones might be like 1 out of 10 of the cars they make. And the letters stopped and nobody was like, good job, guys, you're actually being accurate. But the truth is, in that period, like, you know, E30 and E36 and E46 3 Series, those are all some of the best cars the company's made and some of the best cars in terms of experience and the way they did the job they were designed to do that the industry's ever built. 1 year, what I was getting to, the thing that I said I remember vividly is 1 year we were running P-Cody, that performance car of the year test that Ross mentioned at Road and Track, which is a mix of back roads and track driving, data and the intangibles. And there was a particular editor who disagreed with the entire staff. He was running the magazine at the time. Then I can't name any of the specifics because it'll give it away. And I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. He's a very nice man, but he firmly disagreed with the entire staff about what car should end up with the award that year. And he outvoted them. Or maybe it was an argument that ended it. I don't remember. But the rest of the staff, this particular editor felt that it should be, let's call it, you know, the Fancy Boy 5000. I've used that name before. I love it. Aren't we all the Fancy Boy 5000? And the rest of the staff thought it should be the Econobox 100. And the Econobox 100 was spectacular. It was very, very, very good at everything it was designed to do. And it did that job in a way that no car in that class had done for about 15 years. And we knew the market wouldn't care because Econobox 100s don't sell anymore and cars in that class don't sell anymore. And we wanted to hold it up. It's like, this is a revelation. It is a hark back to the way the Volkswagen GTI used to be, the way every hot hatchback throughout history has been. It's great. And we want to say goodbye to it. And the person at the top felt that it should be the Fancy Boy 5000 because it was fastest and because he liked it. And we also thought there were some other reasons, and that was much discussed over beer and a lot of four-letter words were thrown around. But in the end, it ended up being the Econobox 100. And the Econobox 100 went on the cover, and a lot of people wrote in and they were like, what is wrong with you? There was a Ferrari in that test. There was a Porsche in that test. Why would you pick the Econobox 400? You guys are all flaming assholes with heads made of cheese. And we were like, mm-hmm, yep, all right, expected it. And then people were like, so how much is Hyundai paying you? And we're like, oh, we actually, Hyundai dropped their ad contract a couple years ago. They don't pay us anything. It was one of those things that you cannot explain. You can't tell people. The truth is stranger than fiction, and you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's a weird kind of organic give and take, because it's, again, it's people at the core of it. It is not, you know, a car review, a car magazine is not a, it's not math. It's something else.
So we've talked a lot about the car review part of it.
Yeah.
But some of it and some of the best writing that I've ever read in car magazines have been more the adventures. And can you share, and I don't know if this is the last one, but sort of your favorite adventure story that you wrote for one of the magazines?
Oh, man.
Or had, but didn't write.
Oh,
or couldn't write.
The
That's
adventures,
the secret one we want to know.
The stuff we can't write, the stuff that never got written in car magazines, excuse me, is an entire show in itself. But Ross is right. We're getting close to run out of time, but we should touch on this. The adventures were the best part because it was always and remain the best part, right? Because it was always somebody comes to you and says, would you like, we need a feature story. We need something that shows, illuminates the magazine. Is if it was just reviews, it would be Consumer Reports. If it was just cold-hearted reviews, it would be Consumer Reports with a hangover. Oh, I take that back. That's mostly just Consumer Reports all the time. Consumer Reports is a great publication. I do enjoy it, just not for that. But the other bits that made the magazine were always, and that make a website and make a YouTube channel really, or all anything you make editorially are all there to kind of illuminate the rest of the world around the car. It is not, Ross, give me applause for this. I'm doing what you do. It's not the car. It's not the car, Ross. It's not the car.
Thank you.
Thank you. It is not ultimately just reviews. It was all about the culture around it. And that's also why I got into the business, because those stories end up being about and for people. And so I had a lot of opportunities to do this sort of thing because I loved it. I was a student of the forum, you know, the adventure stories and travel stories, that kind of stuff goes back since the dawn of journalism and writing and storytelling. You know, people were yakking out. I went over that hill and I got almost eaten by a saber-toothed bear tiger when we lived in caves, right? You know, that sort of stuff got trotted out around campfires since the dawn of humanity. But for me, it was always about stuff that illuminated and is always about stuff that illuminated why we do what we do. And sometimes that turned into randomly odd things. I think I've mentioned on the show before the time I drove a Jeep with no doors to the Arctic Circle because reasons. There was a big investigation into, it was kind of a lens on what we do, why we do, where it comes from, and how, what we sacrifice for it. And also, I really wanted to drive to the Arctic Circle in a Jeep with no doors.
And how stupid some people are.
Yeah. And how stupid some people are. Totally. Yeah. And I failed. Yeah. Very stupid. But the one that sticks in my head the most, or the one that comes to mind now, several years ago for Cycle World, I drove my friend Zach and I, who at the time was also a freelancer, we went nonstop from Seattle to Los Angeles in a Ural sidecar motorcycle, which sidecar is motorcycle with a tub on it. Everybody's seen it. People put their dogs in them. A Ural is a 1940s rooted Russian copy of a mid-century BMW that they've slowly evolved in. The way the Russians evolve anything, which is, you know, drink a lot of vodka and go, throw a hammer at it. It slowly evolved over the last 50 years into being a lightly modern vehicle. I think it got a fuel injection a couple years ago, but is still built out of tube steel and, you know, recycled communists and things like that. So we wrote it. I got it in my head that the great thing about the motorcycle and the great thing about motorcycle culture in general is that it exists simply for itself. There is no reason. There is no driving force behind it, except we can do this. Look how amazing it is. And so I started pitching ideas that kind of illuminated that. And one of them was, all right, well, Ural's importer is based in Seattle. They bring the motorcycles in from Russia, sell them through a facility there, goes out to dealers around the country. And the motorcycle business, the car business, the automotive industry is based in Los Angeles, and Cycle World's headquarters were in Orange County. I'm like, well, okay, what if we just nonstop see how far and long we can run it and see if we can get nonstop from Seattle to LA? And then I thought, okay, well, all right, that sounds kind of boring. You just stop and get out, and like at the end of the day, you're there. Because a sidecar is, motorcycles are exhausting to ride. A sidecar is more so, right? And this was a two-wheel drive sidecar where you could occasionally engage the outside wheel, but regardless, every sidecar takes a lot of effort. You know, it's a big uneven triangle shaped platform that's always wanting to do the things it doesn't want to do. Sometimes those things are fall over. Sometimes those things are grind the third wheel into dust because you're putting all the cornering load on it. And sometimes that's just, you're in a crosswind of things catching wind. And so for 3 hours, you're sitting there putting 20 pounds of load into the bars, counter steering down the freeway at 40 miles an hour, pinned uphill, wondering why every single ounce of America is so long. But to make this happen, we ended up, it's a very long story that I'm making very short here, but I decided that the only way to do this was to refill the fuel tank on the road, which meant handing over fuel cans from a chase car to the person in the sidecar, having a transfer pump that was sat in the lap of the passengers, sat in the passenger's lap, and then transferred pump from those cans into the motorcycle tank as it ran, as you rode.
That sounds very safe.
Completely safe. And totally did not end up with anybody covered in gasoline at any point. I promise. No, that's a lie. And the other thing I decided was that, well, if we're going to be in this bike for 30 hours and not get off thing at all, can't be on the freeway, because also a Ural doesn't always do freeway speed because they make like 2.5 hamsters worth of power. So we went down the coast road, which is, you know, Highway 1, what turns into PCH in California, Pacific Coast Highway. And that's a windy, kind of murderous, wonderful thing by the ocean. And I thought, okay, well, if we're going to be doing that, A, you know, if we stop to pee, that'll just trash the average. How are we going to, okay, yeah, well, you know, we can pee in a jug and then toss it overboard. But what about the other thing? What about number deuce? And that took a little bit of thinking. We ended up talking to a nurse of a friend to make another long story short. Did you know that if you drink a pint glass full of olive oil, it will clean you out in extremely short order? Oh. So to be polite, we cleaned out our systems and then corked them up. And then 35 some odd hours went by. There's more to the story, but that was one of them. I remember vividly hallucinating in a snowstorm that we hit in the Sierra about 15 hours in, whenever it was. And it was 2 or 3 in the morning. It was dark. I thought there were little dancing elves in the forest. And it was one of the most magical, stupid, beneficial, pointless times of my life. And we wrote a story about it. There's a video online somewhere. You can find me. We did not go fully nonstop because we had to stop at one point because Zach and I were either hallucinating or so crazy that we heard or thought we heard bearing noises out of the sidecar's outside wheel bearing. Oof. So we stopped, turned it on its side, got the sidecar up in the air. You could just pitch the thing over. It's a sidecar. It's also made in Russia. It's a farm tool. So pitch the thing on the side. There was one of the Ural mechanics was in the chase car and looked at it. And he was like, the Ural mechanic was like, yeah, I adjusted it. And we later found out that he went to the editor who was with us. He's like, there's nothing wrong with it. I think they're losing their minds. And we were like, cool. Yeah. Thank you for adjusting. I feel better now. But that was one version of the stupid, but a lot of it was similar. I was a long story, but you get where I'm going with it, right? A lot of it was pointless, but designed to have a point.
That's good. That's good. Okay. I have one. Maybe this is the final question.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about secrets. I've seen interviews, race car drivers, all the thing. Tell us the one thing your fans don't know about you. So instead of about you, Sam, my question is, tell us the one thing that listeners or readers don't know about, you know, tell us the one secret. You know, we've asked you secrets, but you have one like, well, I hope they don't ask me about that one.
Well, I thought the secret was it had to do with the olive oil and the corking.
Well, that was, yeah, maybe that's it.
I hope that's a secret. Maybe
that's it. You know, is it bad that I was intently listening to Sam? Because that's always a thing before the 24 hours start. I'm like, okay, I was going to pick up some tips because during the 24 hours of Daytona, it's about 36 hours where you don't really want to have to go do that. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna learn something here. So
here's the thing, Jeff. If you try and down a pint glass, I mean a standard like 16-ounce pint glass full of olive oil, doesn't matter how light the olive oil is, your body will attempt to reject it. You can't just, like, if you chug a beer,
terrible. You
just open your gullet, and I haven't done this since college, but I have a decent memory for it, I swear. You open your gullet, kind of go, and then it just pours into you. If you try to do that with olive oil, even the lightest stuff has enough viscosity to it that it starts to like glorp and burble and kind of you back up your throat. And there's your gag reflex sets in, and then the olive oil goes moving around your mouth, and then you start to smell it, and everything smells like, well, awful. And it just keeps going. It took me, Zach is 10 times the man I am. So I think he downed it in like, you know, 30 seconds or whatever it was. And I vividly remember standing in my kitchen in Seattle and my wife and Zach sitting there laughing at me because if it took me 10 minutes, it took me an hour. I don't remember how long it was. I just remember the torture of it. And then you're like hanging around, like, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes later. And there's a moment you're like, oh. And then you stand up and you walk very quickly to a certain room in your house. And then events occur and you are committed, and it's not pleasant, but it's like somebody pumped you full of air afterward. You just have this deeply empty feeling. It's like your stomach has echoes in it.
That's the secret.
You know,
that's the secret.
That's a way. That's all.
I will tell you.
You have nailed it.
I want that
is far beyond what I projected the secret to be, but we'll go with that.
I want to close on one thing, the actual secret that nobody knows about the business. Almost everybody hates SUVs and crossovers. They're all fat, inefficient, big air hole punching things that don't do any of the jobs well that they're designed to do anymore. And most people in the industry really kind of loathe a tool that doesn't do the job it was designed for, but they are what sells. And so that's what people talk about.
Huh.
Yeah. Again, there are exceptions. There's no hard and fast rules, but that's a majority of the people who enjoy driving because, you know, a 4,500 pound thing with very little suspension travel and rubber band thinned tires, sidewalls that are microscopic and a lot of spring rate, isn't going to be great. It's going to behave exactly like it sounds. So, but maybe it'll get better. Fingers crossed.
There you go.
So on that note, we have officially listened entirely too much to my voice today. But that means Ross is rolling his eyes. what do you got, Ross?
I got one last thing.
Okay.
Congratulations on launching your book.
Thanks.
That is really, really cool. And man, it's.
Oh, thank you.
I can't wait to read the whole thing. I've read, I think, just about everything you've read, but I know there's a lot of new stuff in it. So I can't wait.
I can't wait. It's going to be cool. The stories are, I have to admit that I did not read a whole lot of Road and Track stuff. I would always go through for the racing ones. So I've read your racing stories before. If it had a race car in it, I read it. If it had a speed car, not so much, but I can't wait to read the book.
Oh, thanks.
It's going to be great.
I appreciate it. Thanks for letting me talk about this. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Everybody out there, if you're listening, I hope you enjoyed it too. Again, the book is called, I have to pick it up to remember the title, Smithology, Thoughts, Travels, and Semi-Plausible Car Writings, 2003 to 2023. It's available on Amazon, and an ebook version will be coming out soon. But if you want more of this, I promise most of it is not about olive oil. It's a collection of columns, feature stories, ramblings. There's only two pieces of fiction in there, I promise, and no one should read them. But for the most part, it's just a kind of overview of how I think and a lot of the stuff I was lucky enough to do in the silly, silly thing that has passed for my career for the past 20 years. But on that note, we are out of time. That's our show. As always, if you have a second, please take the time to review or rate the show on whatever platform you listen to us on. Follow it, subscribe. That stuff really helps us, really does help us keep the show going, and we very much appreciate it. You guys have been great. We really appreciate all your support, especially on Patreon. The show is growing, and it means a lot to us. Thank you so much for listening. Tune in next week when our topic will be, what is it? It is Ross and Jeff talking about the time they were living during wartime in this kind of neutral enclave in Morocco. And Ross ran a cafe and a gathering place where there was this guy named Sam who played the piano. And Ross was torn between his love for Jeff and helping Jeff's son Colin escape the city to continue fighting other racing drivers and keep them from taking over Europe and eventually the world. But it all ended up with an airplane taking off and Jeff and Ross beginning of a beautiful friendship because, I mean, you know, in this world, this podcast of three little people doesn't amount to a hill of beans. And on that note, I've said 300 times. See you next time. Thank you for listening. Fun.